Janet is a family physician and a theologian. She is from Ontario, Canada, and her presentation today will be Through a Glass Darkly: Human Hindrances to Hearing the Voice of God.
So the theme of this conference is hearing God's voice in nature, but I think before we can even do this, we need to understand what that means. So I'm going to look at this topic from the hearer's perspective. Now, I have a lot of material, and I'll be going fairly quickly through it, but some of it is pretty basic, so I'm sure all of you will have some stuff that's simple to some of you and simple to others. Anyway, I'll just do a blanket apology. And I won't be reading my slides, because you can do that. So those are my basic assumptions. I'm obviously going to be focusing on number three, the idea that humans are able to hear God's voice, but we're imperfect perceivers and interpreters. So first, let's look at the Bible. So the Bible claims that God does talk to us and that we can hear his voice, although there's obviously, and then there's some examples, but there's obviously interpretive nuances around those. But more importantly, there's multiple stories in the Bible of God communicating with his people through images, angels, dreams, visions, as well as inner or audible voices. So that we hear that the voice of the Lord came to Jeremiah, Isaiah, and many others. The famous story of Elijah, where God was not in the earthquake or the storm, but in the silence. Now, discernment is the ability to recognize the divine voice, and it can be described as a gift, and it involves renewing our minds, and it can be used to distinguish good from evil. Now, the second point from the Bible here, that this hearing is often mysterious. It's sensory, involves the imagination. The third biblical point is that humans have responsibility and choice. Proverbs quite often talks about the two ways of that, the way of wicked, the way of the righteous, and so on and so forth. Deuteronomy famously talks about that God has set before us life and death, blessings and curses. Choose life so that you and your children may live. Unfortunately, the Bible also tells us that often we make poor choices. We take the road that leads to destruction. We're foolish and we're sinful. Jesus refers to blind men, especially the Pharisees. And John, in quoting Isaiah, talks about that he has blinded their eyes and hardened their hearts so that they can neither see with their eyes nor understand with their hearts. Matthew talks about though seeing, they do not see. Though hearing, they do not hear or understand. And Paul's dilemma in Romans 7 is well known. So even though the Bible tells us that we can hear God, there's hints that it's going to be difficult. Now, turning to a Christian experience and history, so throughout the history of Christianity, there have been many stories of remarkable as well as ordinary divine encounters. And this is, anybody?
Constantine's
famous vision of the cross. In mystical and contemplative writers, divine communication is often talked about. So Julian of Norwich, for example, talks about thoughts which suddenly appear in my mind. And there's been a resurgence of descriptions of divine encounters with the rise of the charismatic movement. Popular literature is filled with stories of people spontaneously speaking in tongues, being slain in the spirit, receiving visions, experiencing remarkable healings, as well as frequently reporting hearing the voice of God. Now, in terms of theological reflection on this, the classic you may have heard about, Wesleyan quadrilateral, for instance, knowing God through the Bible, through church or history, and through personal experiences. We often talk at this conference about the book of nature, and since God created the world, his voice is everywhere. But I am not sure how helpful that is. I think it's too general, and I think it's more helpful maybe to focus on specific or what's sometimes called special divine communication. And this has been done in theology. First of all, in general, there's a concept that, you know, historically in theology, there's been an emphasis on rationality. So things like faith, the emotions, imagination, and spiritual experiences have often been subsumed by rationality. And obviously, you're familiar with the Enlightenment period where rationality was revered. In general, a lot of theological and spiritual literature focuses on rationality, although recently there's been increasing attention to the importance of imagination and figurative language in the Bible. When you read a lot of discernment literature, they talk about evaluating, so again, a rational cognitive evaluation of the content of what is heard by considering its compatibility with Scripture and discussing it with the church community. So very rational emphasis. Secondly, okay. That's where I am anyway. Second point is that theologians have been doing recently is recognizing the concept of mediation. So we're finite creatures. However, even an ineffable mystical type of experience produces patterns of activity in the brain. So there's always this idea of God's voice is mediated through human physiology. We don't really know exactly how. So even divinely inspired scripture is mediated through the experiences and the voices and the pens of its authors. It's difficult to separate the experience from its expression or the perception from its interpretation. So spiritual experience, for example, is mediated through neural processes, through the local church, through society, history, personal experience, and language. Many differences have been found in Western versus Eastern cultures, for instance. So we can be assured that God does exist and he does speak, but the way that we investigate and explain this is limited by our finite human nature. That first, by the way, is a quote from my PhD supervisor, Mark Cartledge at the University of Birmingham. So again, a quote about the idea of mediation. The third theological issue is to do with emotions, sometimes called the passions or affect. And historically, these were actually affirmed and assumed. There was no reason-faith dichotomy prior to the Enlightenment. So the patristic authors, for instance, talked about the spiritual senses, so the eyes of my heart. Ignatius is ideas of the feelings of consolation, desolation are well-known. John Wesley's warmed heart is also well-known. And Evan Howard, an evangelical, recently has paid attention to the importance of affective processes in discernment, so saying it's not just this logical, rational process. In addition, as I mentioned, the idea of the imagination is getting more attention in theological literature. In the past few decades, there's been increasing focus on the place of the imagination in theology. Many scholars now insist that divine reality can only be known through the faculty of the imagination. And finally, the idea of intuition is often mentioned in theological literature, but it's very seldom is dealt with in any sort of comprehensive manner. It's just sort of mentioned. So the well-known mathematician and philosopher Pascal talks about intuitions of the heart. In the Roman Catholic tradition, Thomas Merton refers to aesthetic intuition. He talks about the intuitive consciousness and intuitive knowledge of God. A more recent Catholic author, Mary Margaret Funk, believes that the logical mind usually misses the symbolic voice heard by the intuitive senses. A lot of evangelical contemplative writers also hint about intuitive processes in discernment. Gordon Smith, for instance, talks about the inner witness of the Spirit. He talks about a direct impression on our inner consciousness. Now, as I mentioned, these authors mention intuition. They don't deal with it from any psychological point of view or any engagement with neuroscience. So I suggest that discernment, hearing God's voice in nature, like most human experience, involves elements of knowledge, judgment, and decision. Therefore, research of cognitive psychology, especially with respect to intuition, is going to be very relevant to Christian discernment. So let's now turn to the human limitations. we can roughly talk about the ABC, the affect, behavior, and cognition, but they're very much intertwined. Interestingly, I was just reading the latest issue of PSCF on the plane over here. I don't know if anybody read the mathematics, but in that, again, I found a couple of articles referencing this threefold aspects of understanding the world. I think Alistair McGrath talks about it as well. But do bear in mind, so that's sort of an outline of where I'm going, but do bear in mind it is somewhat arbitrary and artificial because as I will show, they're all very much intertwined. So let's look at the human brain, first of all. It's a complex mass of billions of neurons which communicate through chemical and electrical means. It's highly responsive and adaptive to its internal and external environments, and it's able to process information simultaneously, so not just sequentially. Most brain functioning actually occurs below the level of our awareness. That's just a very brief map, and it's actually pretty outdated because we now know it's better, instead of talking about locations, it's better to talk about neural circuitry. But that's just to orient you. So the brain and sensory systems are intertwined. So we'll first look at sensory perception and the limits of sensory perception. This is stuff you probably know, so I'm just doing it very briefly. We're all familiar with blind spots. We're familiar with a delay in light perception. You hear the thunder before you see the lightning. Other way around. Never mind. We know that we cannot see all of the light spectrum. We know that dogs have better hearing than human. Birds have better navigational skills than humans. These limitations, though, are probably best demonstrated through illusions. One common one is a vestibular illusion. When you're on a train and the one next to you starts moving, you think yours is moving as well. The visual system ones I can show you more. So Kinesis' triangle at the top, we're probably familiar with, the brain fills in. Our brains always like to seek for patterns. So your brain fills in the triangles even though they're not there. Brain adds information. The Mulalaya illusion at the bottom, what's particularly interesting about this one is that even when we're aware of the illusion and the true state of the world, it's almost impossible to overcome the illusion. We still see, and so the lines are the same length, in case you didn't know that, but we still see them as being different, even though we know that they're the same. There's also a whole group of what are called bistable illusions, where it depends on your perspective, so the duck rabbit one and the old young woman one. And they just demonstrate the difficulty that the brain has with ambiguous information. We can only see one option unless we intentionally focus and change our focal point. So the point of the summary of, and there's a whole lot more, but the summary of this is that we don't really see physical reality. We only see a translation of it or an interpretation of it. We see what our brain tells us. So these perceptual errors draw attention to the fact that sensory perception does not always correspond to reality. And obviously this has implications for hearing the voice of God. Now, what you may be a little less familiar with is limitations in terms of cognitive perception. So we've just learned we can't really trust our senses, so can we trust our brains and our thinking? So there's limits to reason as well as limits to perception. There's paradoxes that you might be familiar with in philosophy. There's a lot of mathematical paradoxes that some of you may be familiar with. I guarantee in almost everybody's specialty area, there's going to be some illustration of this. But the bottom line is the brain does not simply respond to sensory input, but it determines the sensory input based on prior beliefs and expectations. So there's a top-down as well as bottom-up processing. And this has been talked about already in a few sessions today. Alistair McGrath talked about how our theories can limit our understanding. So that's an example of how our prior beliefs will limit our understanding. So the world is not just seen, but it's actually interpreted. The work of Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky is particularly helpful in this regard. They won the Nobel Prize. So they talk about the two neurocognitive processes or two ways of knowing. And the terms are, again, arbitrary. Some people refer to sort of the high road, the low road. They can go through different terms, but just so you know, they are arbitrary labels. So system one is automatic, intuitive. It distinguishes surprising from normal events. It makes rapid associations. It focuses on existing evidence, detects subliminal messages. It's mediated by experience, and it uses parallel processing. System two is more slow and logical. It's mediated by conscious appraisal, justified by evidence, and it uses serial processing. Now, some of our interactions with the world are governed by system one, so the fight and flight response we talked about, recognizing a familiar face at an ASA conference. Some are mediated, governed by system two, such as when you're having your conversation in our social gatherings, being able to hear just one person instead of everyone in the crowd, filling out forms. Some begin as logical and later become more automatic, such as driving. And again, any expert activity will do that. Many involve sort of an interplay between the two processes, and both are imperfect processes, as we shall see. Now, there's a rough correlation between, and you may be familiar with the left-right brain dichotomy, but this has really been shown to be the brain is a lot more flexible than we previously thought. So when people lose part of their brain, another part of the brain will take over, for instance. And as mentioned before, it's really better to think in terms of neural circuitry, which involves multiple parts of the brain. Now, the benefits of system one processing are obvious in chess experts, musicians. Many stories of scientific discoveries are coming through intuitive processes. Think of Archimedes, for instance, and I'm sure you can think of quite a few others. Intuition, interestingly, has even been demonstrated in infants who stare longer at abnormal phenomena, such as a ball stopping midair, something they haven't learned that's wrong, but they intuitively seem to know that. Intuition is indispensable to our daily lives. It operates with little information and without really any effort or awareness on our part. So we can slam our feet on the brakes to avoid an accident, and only then afterwards do we feel the shock of it. It allows us to learn with ease and quickly make emergency decisions. Can be surprisingly accurate. Interestingly, system two, which is the rational logic, it can be incorrect at times. So many studies showing this, but for example, if somebody's asked to give some artwork and asked to pick out the best one, and we're talking like maybe amateurs, they'll intuitively pick out the best one. If you ask them to explain why it's better, and so that's then making them use their sort of rational part of their brain, they'll make errors and they will actually choose the inferior piece of art or, quality of jam. They've done studies. Generally, people make better decisions with less information because system two has difficulty dealing with a surplus of data. So overall, non-conscious intuitive processes demonstrate superior decision making. However, system one also has its weaknesses. Here I'm going to talk about cognitive biases. We tend to create our own subjective social reality from the perception of the input. And this dictates our behavior in the social world. Cognitive biases can sometimes lead to perceptual distortion, inaccurate judgment, illogical interpretation. And there's an example of illogical interpretation. In terms of our judgment, we make many errors about the world. We have difficulty interpreting statistics, and you're familiar with people not flying on airplanes, even though car accidents occur more frequently. We ignore sample sizes, probabilities. System one constantly looks for patterns, so we have difficulty understanding randomness, and we tend to overestimate and overweight rare events. For instance, people will falsely attribute something to God because it's a rare event, but coincidences do happen, and they're memorable. People find significant numbers in the book of Revelation, but it's not beyond the realm of coincidence. We often assume causal effects when there's merely a correlation. Our brains are somewhat lazy. We pay more attention to information that's more easily available, more familiar, more reinforced. We assumed incidents that are reported are more common because they're readily accessible to us. So, you know, how many times have you heard testimonies in church about unanswered prayer? As an example, so the dots on the left are actually the random ones. And we tend to think the opposite because we assume that there's sort of an order to randomness. We're also very susceptible to framing effects and context. So we'll buy meat that's labeled 85% fat-free, but we won't buy meat if it's labeled 15% fat. effects of priming, are you influenced by previous experience, knowledge, expectations? This is the well-known strip test, the red-green, where you ask to say the color of the words, and it's difficult to do. Our judgments are susceptible to effects of mood and fatigue. We're averse to loss. We notice bad events more easily than good ones. In terms of errors about ourselves, we're very self-serving. We assume we're all better than average. We overestimate our conspicuousness. We're overconfident in our knowledge. When we succeed, we take credit for it, or we, as good Christians, we might give the credit to God. But when we fail, we blame others, or we might blame the devil or whatever, or circumstances. They did an interesting study on the Ten Commandments, and people always rated themselves as much more obedient to them than the average person, right? We resist change. We persist in our beliefs despite evidence to the contrary. Hindsight bias, you're familiar with the halo effect. We judge someone's character or the content of their speech by their smile. Think of televangelists, maybe. We place more weight on the opinions of family members, or those who think are similar to us, and one of the previous session today talked about groupthink, also known as the confirmation bias. Now I'm running out of time, so very briefly, memory also can be unreliable. Memories are constructed. They're dependent on our states. So in sum, Einstein applauds intuition. But others are a little bit more guarded, like David Myers. Jonathan Haidt refers to the rational rider and the intuitive, impulsive elephant. That's me riding an elephant in Thailand, by the way. Notice that the driver has his arms crossed in front of them, not even riding an elephant. The point is that our intuitions, our impulses, emotions are much more, are huge and unwieldy, but they can be controlled. So in general, our brains allow us to function well in the world, but they limit us. And again, what we see does not always correspond to reality, with obvious implications for hearing the voice of God. Again, briefly, emotions. So emotions are really intertwined with that sort of intuitive part of our brains. You know, the types of cognitive processing. Emotions are innate. They're actually more primary than cognition. I'll skip through all of that. Oh, that's just to cheer you up after all this depression. Oh, but the point is that we will on a sunny day, we will make very different judgments than on a cloudy day. Human limitations in terms of behavior and choice, decision making. Nothing is value free. Choices, our decisions are always affected by our previous experience, our current state of being, our fatigue, attention. So perhaps we're less free than what we think. There's an innate tendency to be lazy and self-serving. Dare we call that sin? So to conclude, I hope you don't all feel, well, if you all feel really, humiliated, just rest assured that I'm talking about all of us. So just because we're Christian, though, does not mean that we're immune to error. But can we clear the glass to see a little bit more clearly? I believe it is still possible to hear God's voice in nature. And let's talk about, before that, just some of the implications of this understanding. So recall the idea of mediation. So it's possible that the voice of God is experienced primarily through the non-linguistic, non-analytic parts of ourselves, which are variously described as the heart, the intuition, the emotions, the subconscious. But without cognitive consciousness of the experience, the encounter may actually feel unmediated. And there's a whole wide open for research on that. Implications for the theology you might be thinking about already, the nature of divine action, providence, free will, non-conceptual apprehension of God. So we think about pre-verbal or non-verbal people. We think about mystical experiences where language is not required to experience God. The whole idea of nature nurture, or the ideal versus sinful. A question of whether we were actually created this way or whether it's an effect of sin in the world. My feeling is that there's too much that to be explained just by sin in the world and the presence of it in infants and animals. I think there is a largely innate ability, but it's hugely affected by the environment. This research has implications for our personal faith, conduct, and our communal faith, as well as discernment and distinguishing God's voice among others. So what can we do with this? So I think a huge factor is awareness. So you're all here. You're already going to be better because you've learned something, hopefully. So knowing that what we see and remember does not perfectly correspond with reality is sobering. At times, what we think is the voice of God might be our own intuition, and what appears to be the work of God might be a random coincidence. We need to recognize that we tend to search for patterns. And because religion by nature is emotional and personal, we may in fact have more of a tendency towards being self-serving and other biases. But we can learn to adapt and adopt the tools of rationality, like understanding scientific reasoning and realizing the two cognitive processing systems. We can consider alternative explanations, double-check facts, consult with others. We can lighten our cognitive load, reduce multitasking, for instance, ensure our moods are good before making important decisions, learn how to control the elephant, when to use our rational minds, when to use our intuitive ones. We can cultivate our contemplative imaginative neural networks and make space for God, allowing God to speak to through uncluttered channels. And we can intentionally turn to God. We can consider things like spiritual disciplines. So we're less likely to hear God if we're listening to someone else. We're less likely to see God if we're looking somewhere else. And though we see through a glass darkly and we're limited in our ability, He is able to break through the clouds, but we can do our part in preparation. Thank you.
We have time for one question.
Sure. Thanks for the presentation. So just a question about hearing from God. I guess in some, or perhaps many, charismatic or Pentecostal circles, when people feel like they hear from God, then they check against, say, scripture, or they look for confirmation from maybe other people who are also praying or trying to listen to God. Mm-hmm. Can you speak about that and the effectiveness of that in this whole context?
Sure. So what I would sort of want to do with, you know, a zillion ways to go on that, but one would be thinking that perhaps the hearing the voice of God is an intuitive type thing, but then we control the elephant, so to speak. We consult with someone else and consult with scripture, so we're using our rational brains to evaluate the intuitive understanding. The second thing I would want to say to that is not just consulting with someone else, but also asking yourself all the questions that I just went through. Okay, so what I heard from God, is that affected by what I ate for lunch, or what happened to me yesterday, or what I was really hoping for, or the latest book I just read, or, you know, so asking all those questions in addition, I think can be helpful.
All
right.
Can I use a transition to ask one question?
Absolutely. Oh, it's your time, sure.
So I think I've seen, you know this very well, but I'm pretty sure I've seen a study that looked at how, it's basically confirmation bias, mm-hmm. is related to intelligence. And that study had evidence that said that the main thing, part of intelligence, is we defend our confirmation biases much better than people that are lower in intelligence.
Right, right, yes, yes. There are a few different studies showing that, yeah, for sure. It seems to be done in politics, I think, as well, particularly, yeah.
And I,
So that's what I said before about people will stick to, even when there's evidence to the contrary,
yeah.
They will stick to it, and the more intelligent, and in moral psychology it comes up as well, mm-hmm. right? So the more intelligent someone is, the better, more explanations they can give for to defend their wrong
yeah.
assumption.
Now, it occurs to me that also that I never saw any study on this, but religious people might do that even better because we think, well, God told me this,
yeah,
so.
Exactly. Yeah, that's